TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate change is here. Now what? Professor Bill Collins. There are three surprises embedded in this headline. Climate change is here, a statement of fact, in a time of climate change denial. Combined with the question, now what? That seems to indicate a new turn for scientists who hesitated for so long to make recommendations. Also, this acknowledgement of the current situation is coming out of a venerable 75-year-old institution, the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. They conduct scientific research on behalf of the U.S. Department of Energy. In September 2015, the Berkeley Lab established the Climate and Ecosystem Sciences Division to understand, predict, and advance stewardship of the Earth's climate and ecosystems. Professor Bill Collins is the director. He's an expert in climate change science. Professor Collins also is the director of the Climate Readiness Institute, a new multi-campus initiative to prepare the San Francisco Bay Area for climate change. As I'm recording this in June 2016, there are still very few places on Earth where academia and public policy representatives are collaborating on specific plans to respond to climate change. And that includes sea level rise, heat waves, health issues, and more. You are about to hear a lively Q&A over geoengineering, carbon intensity of food and agriculture, air pollution, and heat waves. These are excerpts from an almost two-hour event that also covered direct recommendations for the San Francisco Bay Area and, by implication, any city on the ocean. The local specifics can be found on the Berkeley Lab YouTube channel under Climate Change is Here. Now what? He is Professor Bill Collins from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. The moderator is Berkeley Lab's Jeff Miller.
We tend to emphasize carbon, but what we haven't discussed so far is something called the short-lived climate pollutants, soot and methane. Now methane.
Yes.
Pernicious methane.
Pernicious methane. Man is now the major source of methane in the climate system. We outrank natural sources by a factor of 2 to 1. The two dominant sources of methane in the climate system and from man are, again, from fossil fuel production and recovery, for example, from coal mines, and from agricultural activities. Again, fortunately, methane has a relatively short lifetime in the Earth's climate system. It's less than a decade. And we're starting to see concerted action in the United States. President Obama has made it a central tenet of his climate action plan to get a handle on methane sources. And we've also seen action in Asia and around the world in trying to get a handle on this problem. Japan is experimenting with rice paddies, for example, that emit much less methane than traditional inundated rice paddies. So countries around the world are really facing this issue very squarely.
How does it rate with carbon in terms of its intense damage that it does?
In terms of its total impact on how much we've changed the Earth's greenhouse effect, it's a third as big as carbon dioxide. But the problem is that it's 30 times more effective pound for pound than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. In this country, we're really touting methane and natural gas as a wonderful source. It is wonderful. It produces half as much carbon dioxide per BTU as coal.
But
because of this 30 times fold intensity of its greenhouse effect, you cannot tolerate leaks in the system. And the U.S. has built an energy infrastructure around recovering and delivering natural gas that is highly leaky and is very poorly characterized. And we now know, thanks to measurements made in part at Berkeley Lab, that there's twice as much methane being emitted over the United States as EPA claimed. And we should be very grateful to EPA for having tried to characterize it, but there's twice as much there as they thought.
And what role does fracking play?
Well, we've literally reinvented the Wild West. But this time around, the gun that's facing us is not, it's a loaded gun, but it's a loaded gun that involves natural gas. I think we have to get a handle around the leaky sources of the methane and the very leaky delivery system, because otherwise the benefits from natural gas are largely offset by these leaks into the Earth's climate system. Let's just look at what happened in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles had a leak that equaled essentially all the cars on the streets of Los Angeles during the period when that leak was active. And this is a leak from one single reservoir of natural gas. So that sort of sets the scale of the problem for you.
Now we're going to move to one of my favorite topics. Let's talk about livestock and agriculture. So what role do feedlots play in the methane picture?
So agriculture is worldwide, including animal husbandry, is one of the top three sources of methane. We're going to have to address its role as a major source of greenhouse gas. You brought up feedstocks or animal husbandry, I think, in particular on the issue of whether or not we change our food mix in the future. And I think that's something we're going to have to think about mm-hmm. very seriously. In terms of a truly sustainable mix of food that goes much easier on the land surface, goes much easier on the surrounding environments, this is, again, going to take we brought up behavioral shifts at the beginning of this conversation. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to require some major behavioral shifts. And this is a very deep-seated issue for a lot of people. I think a lot of people really like the food that they eat. I think they're going to have to think again.
Should we all become vegetarians? Is that a recommendation from this evening?
Well, I'm not going to proselytize around food. This is something that it's a very frequent thing to do in Berkeley. I'm not going to fall into that trap. Okay. I will say, just I'll only speak personally around this issue. Once we entered into a water crisis, I went from being a vegetarian to a vegan, mm-hmm. precisely because the water commitment to, for example, milk, which I was happy to pour in my cereal every morning, is four times bigger than that of soy milk. So what sort of flipped the switch for me to go from being a vegetarian to vegan was the issue around water. I think it's very important for us to be mindful about the impacts of the food that we eat. You know, I will also freely admit, and I'm guilty of this, as guilty as anyone else who's wandered into the fabulous grocery stores that we have here and gone and look at this vast array of food, much of which, you know, I don't even sure what hemisphere it's coming from. Do I care about which hemisphere it comes from before I put it in my food cart? No. Should I?
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think one thing that would be kind of cool is if we had in our markets not only the thing that weighs how much the food, weighs the food, but a different scale that said, here's the carbon commitment. So you could take two bags of apples, right? One grown 50 miles away, another one grown in South America, and drop them on this scale and sort of look at what happens to the carbon. Wouldn't that be a cool concept in a grocery store? I think we as a public have to demand information. So one thing that we are much less cognizant of than people, for example, in London and elsewhere, is that they have really internalized the carbon commitment around every mile that they drive. And that message around the carbon commitment of how much carbon you emit for every mile that you drive your car has been deeply internalized, for example, in the UK. We need to demand that information about all of our activities so that we internalize the choices that we make and what climate impact they have, so we can make smart choices around climate impact. We have been denied that information. We have to demand it. I think once we get that information, then we need to build, you know, cohorts and communities around solutions. And I think we then have to demand that our policymakers act on this information. And the example I want to bring up is, think about how much of a third rail touching Social Security is that politicians immediately react to and steer clear from. I'm sorry to say that, unfortunately, gun control is one of those. We have to make climate change the third rail in politics. But we need to make sure that politicians recognize that they will be voted out of office in a heartbeat if they do something that's climate stupid. We need to get to the point where that is a thing.
In the Berkeley Lab tradition, I love it. Yeah. Do we have any questions in the audience? Please raise your hand.
I've heard that there is a lot of methane up in the Arctic that will be released as the permafrost is melted. Mm-hmm. Is that methane release incorporated into contemporary models? Because I heard that it wasn't in past IPCC models.
Right. So that the capability of modeling that methane has been coming online. We did a lot of research on that at Berkeley Lab. I'm proud to say that we were the first group to build a fully prognostic or predictive methane cycle for use in climate models. The challenge there is that there's a huge amount of carbon stored in permafrost. It's 10 million square kilometers of frozen soil up around the Arctic Circle. According to certain estimates, twice as much carbon locked up in that permafrost as there is in the Earth's atmosphere. So the critical question is, how does that methane come out, as carbon dioxide or as methane? There are a number of groups worldwide that are now measuring this. I am happy to say that the measurement suggests that when the permafrost thaws, the majority of that carbon is coming out as carbon dioxide, not as methane. But it's still an issue. It's something that the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation and actually all the member countries in the Arctic Council are hard at work trying to solve. And we are bringing those capabilities online in the climate model. So that's becoming a real-life capability now. But excellent question.
But when you think about the whole, the larger intellectual infrastructure and research infrastructure in the U.S., I mean, are we really aligned properly to meet this problem, or do we need to do some major structural changes in that?
No, we are not aligned properly to deal with this problem. Let me just compare and contrast the amount of money that the U.S. spends, and I don't mean to single out the U.S. on this issue, but the amount of money the U.S. spends on weapons R&D versus climate R&D, it's over a factor of 10. So the U.S. spends somewhere in the range of $70 billion a year on weapons research. And if you look at the sum total spent on climate, it's just around 6. It's a factor of 10. We should be looking at this as if this is a Manhattan Project, but a Manhattan Project with a worthy outcome, and one that's going to take a century to play out. But we need to be dedicating resources to it as if it's that scale of challenge.
I want to get back to the heat wave example just for a second, because I think what we might see when we're talking about climate equity is the possibility that in substandard housing, that's also sometimes an issue, like there was in France, massive heat waves, there could be people dying as a result of that, and that would be disproportionately happening in these underprivileged areas is what I'm assuming. So this is a serious threat.
Yes, it is a serious threat, and this is one where the climate models are in complete agreement about what's going to happen. There's really no ambiguity. The only ambiguity is that most of the climate change we're going to see between now and 2040 is already in the pipeline. What happens after 2040 is really something where we have a major choice about which path we follow. If we choose to follow business as usual pathway, we're going to be looking at a situation where the southern part of the United States is experiencing permanent, perpetual heat waves every summer that would be a serious threat to human health. And this is an extremely robust prediction. This, by the way, affects not only the United States, it affects China. So the Berkeley Lab has taken this result and shown it to the previous premier in China. It affects the whole Mediterranean area in Europe. It affects the whole Northern Hemisphere. So this is an issue that we have to face squarely. And again, we're sort of framing this in a human context, but we also have to think about the implications of this for ecosystems. We've sort of punched the accelerator in terms of how rapidly ecosystems have to change to meet a very different thermal environment. And some of them can't change fast enough. The humans, you know, we cohabit this planet with a really remarkable diversity of life, and we have to be mindful of the fact that we're stressing them out as well.
This is the web of life that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Okay, we have a question in our live audience. Yeah. What do you think about climate engineering?
Some people have decided that we have essentially thrown in the towel and said that we should not deal with the root cause of the problem, which is emitting greenhouse gases. We should apply really, really big band-aids to the system. Mm-hmm. These fall into a bucket known as geoengineering. Some of them involve creating what amounts to a permanent volcano. Volcanoes cool the climate system, and so the strategy there has been to pump sulfur aerosols into the stratosphere using a fleet of 747s flying 24/7 and creating an artificial volcano. That's an example of geoengineering. There are other people who've thought about blowing sea salt into the lower Earth's atmosphere to create more clouds. Low-altitude clouds reflect sunlight. They help to cool the climate system. There are people who like to think bigger and who want to create an artificial sunspot by parking a 1,000-kilometer-wide silver-coated mylar disk between us and the sun. So there are a range of solutions. We have to take this seriously because somebody might be tempted to think about it. I want to come back to this climate equity issue here as well.
Yeah.
So the climate community is now reluctantly looking at these solutions in terms of how effective they are, what their side effects are, how long you would need to maintain them to... This is a little bit like keeping your fingers in the dike. What things are still happening despite your attempt to engineer the way of the problem. And for the very first time in the last IPCC assessment, we presented information about that. And there's now a serious activity, ongoing activity to characterize these geoengineering solutions. None of them, for the most part, address the fact, with one possibility of carbon capture and sequestration in deep earth formations, which is, at this point, we don't know how to do it on an industrial scale. None of them address the fact that, seriously address the fact that if you continue to emit carbon dioxide and you don't get rid of it, you will acidify the oceans. So reflecting sunlight does nothing about ocean acidification. And that's taking out the bottom rung of the oceanic food chain, which is not a smart thing to do. Many of them have very nasty side consequences. And the other issue that we haven't, coming back to the climate equity issue writ large, we're very worried about people going rogue with them.
Mm-hmm.
So what if somebody decides that, you know, they're just going, hey, this is cheap. Let's give it a whirl.
Yeah.
Without doing so in the context of an international treaty. I will give you my personal opinion.
Please.
All of them constitute a form of triage on a patient that is hemorrhaging.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are deep-rooted solutions. They are just a form of triage. I'd like to think about this problem in the same way that we faced World War II. And this is one of the reasons why I'm optimistic. As I go to museums like the Rosie the Riveter Museum,
mm-hmm.
And I look at what the way that this country pulled together during the Second World War to face that challenge. And this was a situation where that, you know, the message around conservation and around saving and around pulling together. You know, you talk to our grandparents, and they'll describe to you what it was like to run on the same set of rubber tires for 5 years in a row and patch them. We need to get to a point where the country is facing this as a grand shared challenge. With all hands on board trying multiple things at the same time, there's not a single magic bullet. There are a few that have been identified, like externalizing the cost of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to look at this as something where we have to try a whole bunch of things. Some of them will fail. Some of them will fail spectacularly.
Mm-hmm.
But at least we'll get to a solution, and it won't be for lack of trying.
Okay. Another question from the audience.
Yes. Can you talk just a little bit more about the role of business here in the Bay Area in mm-hmm. driving solutions towards climate change here?
Part of the way that businesses can help does center on this issue around innovation. And we are really fortunate to live in a part of the country that values innovation. The lab has been a major partner in spawning a number of companies that are looking at alternative fuel sources and working very hard on growing those industries to the point, the companies to the point where they're viable. At the other end of the scale, if you look at some of the very largest companies in the Bay Area, talking about the information sector, they are acutely aware of the fact that they cannot continue to on their current curves of growth and succeed as businesses. They have to dramatically lower the energy intensity of the information services that they're providing us. And so the Googles of the world, the Intels of the world are working extremely hard to bend that the energy intensity of the information industry. That's bracketing basically all the way from extremely small startups all the way to the largest companies we have in the South Bay. They're all engaged in this. And to give you an example, the very example that's near and dear to my heart because I work with computers a lot, the computers that we would need to model climate change at the scale where we could simulate San Francisco currently would require dedicated nuclear power reactors, gigawatt power reactors. We think we'll actually be able to deploy those with 1/50th the energy intensity by the time they come online in 10 years. And this is thanks to innovations that are being driven by companies in the South Bay. So there's a lot of good news here in terms of the innovation sector.
Okay, another question from the audience. We have time for a couple more.
I have a question for you. I'm intrigued by your idea of the magic scale that determines the carbon footprint of items in stores. I realize that technologically and politically, that's probably not going to happen in the near future. But if I wanted to put together such a list, does the data exist, and where would I need to look to do it?
So there's been a lot of work done both at Berkeley and elsewhere to look at the carbon intensity of not just what we do in terms of our local activities driving, but in terms of us as consumers. And so there's no consumer carbon intensity information that's been done sort of in at the level of census levels. It's not terribly specific, but that information exists for the Bay Area. And you can go in and look at the consumer carbon intensity of your neighborhood thanks to these kind of tools. So these measure what we do in terms of our local commute. Mine happens to be particularly short, but they also factor in the fact that 15% of the University of California, Berkeley's carbon footprint is due to people flying, people like me, and the carbon intensity of our food. So that information is now available, fortunately.
Okay, a couple more questions.
On the subject of hopeful elements in this whole discussion, basically, are there any natural negative feedback loops? There are lots of scary positive feedback loops, but what are the, you know, what, if any, are the negative feedback loops of climate change that nature has to offer?
There are negative feedback loops. The problem is that they operate on really slow timescales. So you can go to the Grand Canyon and see a beautiful example, just walking from the rim down to the Colorado River, sort of play back the tape of climate change. And you can see the action of these climate feedbacks play out in front of your eyes. The climate feedbacks that will draw down carbon dioxide, there are some fast-acting ones, things like trees. There are longer-lived ones like the ocean. The ocean contains 50 times as much carbon dioxide as the Earth's atmosphere. That takes 3,000 years, though, to do its work. And then you've got geologic ones that take tens of thousands of years to do their work. It's thought, for example, that one of the reasons why we were able to form Antarctica, that's a feedback that took tens of millions of years to act. So there are feedbacks. That's the good news. The problem is that we have punched the accelerator in terms of introducing carbon dioxide into the Earth's atmosphere, and we're currently operating at 10,000 times what nature normally does. We're about to hit 100,000 times. So we're going to take the climate back this century, the Earth's carbon dioxide level, back to levels it hadn't seen for 30 million years. And those feedbacks just don't operate quickly enough to handle a situation where you're driving toward the cliff and you decide to floor it. So, yeah.
Okay, last question for the evening. Who will it be?
Scientists at several different universities tried to look into the carbon intensity of food and see what made the food more or less carbon intensive. Mm-hmm. And all of them came to the same conclusion that the main contributor to the carbon density was not the shipping, but the production of the food. Mm-hmm. And that in effect, if you were to eat apples shipped from halfway around the world, it would be a far, far lower carbon intensity than if you were to eat locally grown beef.
You do have a point there. And I was trying to dodge this issue about protein selection.
We're back to vegetarianism.
Back to vegetarianism. I want to pose the same question with respect to our Pacific Rim. Look at the impacts of cultures that are devoted to fishing in a completely unsustainable way. I mean, we are as a planet going to have to shift cultural practices around food. You raise a perfectly good point. I mentioned that I went from being a vegetarian to a vegan, so imagine why I went to being a vegetarian. It's partly for that reason as well. We're really going to have to think very consciously, and frankly, we're not going to have a choice anymore about how to live sustainably on this planet. I want to, again, broaden the lens back from just what we eat, because this is a favorite topic. But we also have to think about how what we eat affects the web of life around us. We need to move to a mode where the fact that we've killed off a species is headline news above the fold on the newspaper. This has to be something where, again, we need to internalize the idea that the web of life is really precious, and the loss of a single salamander species trumps Trump.
Ah, and on that note, we will close. Yeah. Thank you, audience. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Good night.
Good night.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour program with Professor Bill Collins, director of the New Climate and Ecosystem Science Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Collins also is director of the Climate Readiness Institute, a multi-campus initiative to prepare the San Francisco Bay Area for climate change. As lead author on the fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Collins was a co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Thanks to the Berkeley Lab for their March 24, 2016 recording. They posted the event on YouTube at the Berkeley Lab channel under the title, Climate Change is Here. Now what? You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. For more information, call 707-463-2654 or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.